This is The Dean's Desk with Kurt Mueller, Dean of the Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design.
Hello, everyone. Our guest today is James Dunlop, a professor in the School of Media in the Creative Advertising program. Welcome, James.
Well, hi. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you here. We had a conversation at a networking event for advertising students, which was fantastic. But at that event, we talked a little about artificial intelligence and its impact on advertising, as well as a little bit about your background. So why don't we start with a bit about your journey to Seneca? You've had a great career, and your background is quite similar to mine in terms of a humanities background.
True.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about what brought you to Seneca.
Sure. Well, actually, I'm originally a native of BC. I grew up there and moved to Toronto and sort of got into advertising. And I've been doing that for, I think, nearly, I don't want to date myself here, but a long time. And you go through various phases of that, different levels of growth. You know, you learn to, I was started as a copywriter, and eventually I sort of became a creative director. And then you sort of learn those kind of skills and you keep growing. I've sort of migrated into the freelance world. Again, that's a different set of skills, more sort of you're applying business and working for yourself. And then the next growth, I sort of stalled, but where else can I grow? And I thought, I'd like to teach. It's time to pass on some of the craft. So I knocked on Seneca's door a couple of years ago, actually, and I taught my first classes in the other campus at 7 in Woodbine, and that went quite well. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I love the energy of the classroom, and I think that I have a natural instinct for teaching. My son always tells me, Dad, enough with the lectures. I think we got it from here. Like, he's actually a writer as well in the business, so we share a lot of stuff, and I think I overteach. So, but I'm drawn to it, and so I came back to Seneca, I think, last year, and we're doing it again. So I'm hoping to grow it this time rather than sort of stop doing it. I'm hoping to continue on years from now would be great.
Well, that's great. I feel like I have a sense as to folks who would make a good professor, and I felt that. We met at the advertising event, so it's great to hear you're enjoying it. Our backgrounds are sort of similar in the sense that we both have humanities degrees, and we both sort of wrote for a living for a while before coming to Seneca. But I wanted to know, from your perspective, what does a copywriter, what does a creative director do? What is that job like?
Well, when you start out, I'm trying to sort of zoom back in time to when the people who are listening to this might be sort of that when I was that age. Sort of make it relevant to them. But you start out as just a sponge. You start out like learning the craft, finding somebody who at your agency or somebody in your community that you can sort of be your mentor or follow their footsteps. Or if it's your professor, you know, stay in touch with them and continue to learn. But you're just drinking up the craft. As well, you're a student of people. As a writer, as any kind of writer, I think as an author or a copywriter or even as a speech writer, or a journalist, you're watching people, you're seeing how people work, and particularly my field was advertising, so it's you're learning how to influence people, what influences them, what makes them tick. I mean, I can sit in a restaurant alone and be quite entertained by making up story. I wonder what they're doing, and I'll make it up in my head. I know what their story is, and I'll just make it up. So you're watching people and seeing how they behave. So that's how you get into writing and become a better writer and start practicing the craft. And it's a feedback loop. As you get more kind of feedback on yourself, you can improve. And then you migrate over to this. If you're lucky and you want to, you migrate up to the sort of management of being a creative director and actually running a creative department. And it's a weird step because they say, well, you're good at writing ads and or funny jokes and putting logos at the end. Go manage those people who write jokes and put logos at the end. It's a completely different skill set. You're not trained to run people. You're trained to write. So you kind of make a few mistakes, or I did. And then again, the feedback loop starts again and you get better at doing it and learning how to work with people. It's a lot of HR skills. So again, for me, it was a lot of growth. I was able to actually like go somewhere with it. And I've always kept writing. I've always described myself, it's an overused phrase, but as a player coach. But I set direction and I get in the boat and I start rowing with everybody else.
What is your creative process like when you're not in your directing role yet, you're still copywriting? What does that process look like for you when you are starting to, I've heard the phrase, the terror of the blank page, right? How do you start?
That's a really good question, because I think everybody's probably, there's certainly some commonality, but I think everybody's a little different. And we're all terrified. If you're not, you're not doing it right. Like there's something wrong. If you can just keep in reinventing the same stuff, it's boring and that's not the job. So yeah, there should be a little bit of, I don't know how to do this one. It might be, the last one might have been my last success. And this is the first time I'm going to be exposed as a fraud kind of thing. Luckily, it hasn't happened yet to me, but I start with, and I think this is one of the changes that I've seen in the last sort of 20 or 30 years of doing this job, is I start with a really deep look at the brief and working closely with the strategy. There's always something in there that will feed the ideas. And once you're linked in with a strategy, first of all, you're on brief. You can't be off brief because you're joined at the hip from the foundation, as it were.
What does on brief mean?
Well, I mean, what I mean by that is, I mean, the people throw around this term strategy a lot, but you're strategically, you're delivering what the client has bought off on as the strategy. We're going to position this product as to this kind of people. It's going to be, okay, let's say it's soap. Is it cheaper? Is it more effective? What's the strategy you're going to pick? And then you write that into what's called a brief, or the strategy people or the account people. Sometimes if there isn't a strategist, we write that into a brief. And I start there. I dig right into that. And I look at the kernel in that document is the real thinking, and the hard part, and it's not in every brief, is the insight. And again, that's what is the universal truth that people, what's the itch we're going to scratch that this product can actually deliver? And I'll give you an example. I don't know if it's a famous one or an infamous one, but it's one that I love to point at, and I've probably used this in class. For years and years and years, I don't know if you remember the campaign, Calgon Soap ran a line, Calgon Take Me Away. And the visual was a woman in a bathtub with some rose petals and her candles. And it was probably Friday night, and she had her wine, and she had a tough week, and she was a mom and a housewife, and she was just, Calgon was the bath salts that just let her escape. And a really smart strategist who understood what real insight meant and how insight could drive an ad, and this, I'm getting back to the point, I promise, changed that. And he said, he did some research, and it always comes out of research. That's the part I don't like to do, but they do, and they do really well. And then they distill it into a thought. And he said, women don't want to escape. Hardworking housewives don't want to escape. They want to be acknowledged. So he turned the strategy from escape to, now we recognize, Calgon became the brand that then recognized, I haven't got an ad to point at, but that's a shift in the way, it's a different insight, and it's a shift in strategy. And that's what I would lean into. So I would then go, how do we express a recognition in a creative way? Mm. And that will give you an idea. And from an idea, we can develop executions that actually deliver that.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Absolutely. We are here with James Dunlop, who is a professor in the creative advertising program at Seneca. James, I was interested. I looked at your LinkedIn, and you mentioned in your profile that you pursue an anti-taupe agenda. and I wondered what you meant by that.
Well, the students that I've taught will probably know me. They may not know that that's the phrase that I've used, but I think a good copywriter is someone that's looking for fresh solutions to business problems, not just bland. I don't want to write stuff that or create stuff that's invisible that nobody notices. I want it to be colorful or sparkly or magic or whatever it is that, and usually it's coming from out of that insight. It comes out of that insight that there's a, if we can deliver it in a surprising way in the execution, then it's not taupe, right? Then it's colorful, then it's brilliant.
Hmm. And taupe is that neutral
color. Taupe is that neutral color that nobody can even really describe it, right? It's off beige, slightly cream, maybe khaki, somewhere in there, right? That's it's the color of oatmeal.
That's really it. So in using that philosophy in your career, are there particular campaigns or projects that you are quite proud of that align with that, that
process? Yeah, I think one of the questions in the that you'd given me was, what am I most proud of? And I think the ones that I'm probably most proud of are, and they're a bit romantic, a bit sexy and kind of glamorous, but they're campaign launches or relaunches. When you take a brand, like we took Cadillac and we introduced, your students who are in their 20s now probably won't remember that Cadillac used to be a brand, or it was for years and years, it was your granddad's brand. It was a big floaty boat. It was a living room on wheels. It was a luxury. And from the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s into the 90s, that's what it was. And Cadillac realized that its audience was quite physically dying, literally dying, going away. And they needed to appeal to a younger audience. So we got to relaunch that. That's a huge brand to relaunch. And they actually started, and I don't overuse this phrase, but literally from the ground up, they redesigned the car with sharp edges. It had, I don't even remember, old Cadillacs were kind of rounded and soft looking. These had knife sharp edges, you know, the CTS, the ATS, they're now out, they're quite common, but at the time, that's not what a Cadillac looked like. Mm. And they put it up against the BMW 3 Series and the Mercedes C-Class. This was a sports car now. It was no longer a luxury car. It was a luxury sports sedan. And we got to launch that. And we got to launch it with writing and billboards and art direction that needed to reflect that edge.
Mm.
And I used that in a double launch. I don't know if they'll forget that.
I saw what you did. So when you're doing a relaunch of a brand like that, are there any strengths from the previous incarnation that you can continue with? Or is it basically, how do you do that without sort of disrespecting the previous history?
That's a great question. That's a great question. Because the client and the strategist who is interpreting the client will often say, you know, we don't want to alienate the current audience. You know, we got 50-year-olds who still have money, they're going to be dead in 20, 30 years, but they still might be buying their last Cadillac, but we got to get the new guys too, or the new people coming on the block. So I can give you a headline that we actually wrote six. Back in the day, Kurt, there was a thing called a newspaper, and people, it was actually made of paper, and people, like, it would come every day.
I used to write for one.
You did, yeah. Yeah, you and I understand. So we wrote these full-page Globe and Mail newspaper ads, which was, at the time, was a full page of real estate. We wrote long copy, and I wrote a headline. I discovered that this car, you could buy a manual, you could get a manual, which is, in this day and age, it's unusual. And I thought that was kind of weird. So I wrote a headline that something along the lines of, in 1952, we invented the automatic transmission for luxury. Now we're bringing back for the luxury of driving, and now we're bringing back the manual for exactly the same, the gear stick for exactly the same reason. So reflecting on the old idea that we've gone automatic to make it all easy for you, we're rethinking that for the younger folks now who want to drive a car with a stick shift. Mm. So it's the same thought, just repackaged.
Mm, really interesting. You know, that brings me to a project underway at Seneca called Human Skills, where we're embedding some of these problem-solving, empathy-related communication skills into curriculum in every program. It sounds as though those have always been important in advertising, but even more so now.
For sure. You know, the superheroes, the people that I really look up to, older mentors who are getting even out of the business now, and younger people too, who are doing great new work, have always applied that kind of thinking, for sure. And it's what leads to, in my opinion, it's what leads to better work. And it's what I try to infuse in my classes. Not always successfully, but some of the more keen, passionate students will often pick it up and start running with it and realize that it actually opens up a whole world and it stops that terror of the blank page. It actually helps you think more deeply and more richly. Stuff comes to you.
What is it that you say you like teaching more than you enjoy, more than you anticipated?
Yeah.
Was there anything in particular that you went, oh, wow, I could really do this. I really enjoy it. Is there anything that...
I think when it's the feedback you get from the... Or it's the feedback I got back from the students, the wide eyes, they're hungry. The keen ones are hungry for... And that's the ones that I'm really teaching to. Like, again, it's that energy that I just love to get the sense of, this is working. Something I'm saying is landing. Even if it's just old war stories that they're, you know, they're on the edge of their seat with their chin in their hands, you know, just loving to hear interesting old kooky tales from the bygone era, you know, mixed in with some of the actual, you know, teaching points as well. But when you see that being reflected back at you and the keenness and the wonder, it infuses me with I want to come back and do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, it's really gratifying. Yeah. I remember it from my teaching days. I missed that.
Yeah,
I miss that from my teaching days. We are here with James Dunlop, a professor in the creative advertising program at Seneca. James, in our first meeting, we talked very briefly about the impact of artificial intelligence mm-hmm. on advertising.
Can you
unpack what you're seeing in that area?
Yes. I can tell you what I'm seeing, and it's changing, if not month to month and day to day. And I actually, my position is to actually introduce it in my classes and say, this is a tool and treat it that way. Just like the internet was a tool, it's not going to write your ideas for you. It's not going to, yes, ChatGPT can write ideas. They're not yet very good. They might one day be great. I don't know. But I think one of the things that I've been kicking around in my head is, as a new tool comes on, it unlocks new opportunities and new potential, if it's used properly, I think. And I wonder now if there's a new kind of role that's required, that's no longer a copywriter, although they still might be relevant. But is there a copy engineer, somebody that can write those prompts better and with that bring in some creative direction? Because what ChatGPT or something like that needs is somebody with an eye to go, that's not very good, this is better, and then start feedback looping on that better quality output to improve it beyond. Like machine learning, of course, is going to add infinite and make it better and better.
Yeah.
So I think there is a place for it.
Yeah, I agree. I use it in a similar fashion when I'm writing, you know, even an email. And I never use the exact email or the exact content that I was given, but it can give me a jumping off point.
For sure.
Right? So, yeah, I totally see that. In the interview we did with you, well, I didn't do it. Our star radio student, Brennan, did it. but when Brennan interviewed you ahead of time, you said something that I found very interesting, considering how successful you've been and the amazing career that you've had. And you said that you are wrestling with the relevance of the skills that you bring to what you do. What do you mean by
that? I was hoping you'd ask that, because I really am, metaphorically, at a bit of a crisis. and I'll, this is it. I'm wondering, I'll jump to the end point and I'll come back and explain it. I'm wondering if we're in actually a post-literate world now. And what I mean by that is, my job for my whole career has been to get people's attention and to use that to sell a product or service. And now I go to TikTok and I see that a baby poking his finger in his eye gets 8 million views. Right? There's no writing in that. There's no thinking in that. There's no thought in that. And it's empty. It's like junk media is like junk food, right? It's delicious. It tastes good. I got to get another one. But at the end of it, it's empty calorically. There's nothing in it. Does it really matter, though? Like, I'm wondering if writing is actually becoming less relevant and we are becoming an attention society that's post-literate. Mm. You know, I've had people tell me, and they're usually older people at my age, say, writing will always be relevant, or thinking will always be relevant, or content is king. And yeah, but a baby poke in his eye is content. And I don't know that, it's got no writing in it. It's got no thinking in it. So I'm beginning to wonder if my skill set is still relevant. What do I bring to the table? Maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but are we teaching that at Seneca? Are we teaching the old ways? Or are we ready to adopt a post-literate class of copywriting? I don't know what that would even look like. Hmm. That's what I'm wrestling with.
I hear you. And it's a question I've heard posed in other industries as well, and specifically creative industries. But I feel personally that there's a certain, in terms of artificial intelligence, there's a certain sterility to the content that these engines produce. And there is still a space for oversight and the infusion of the human creative impulse into that. And I mean, some of those TikToks that you speak about, there's sometimes not even a human being involved in generating those, right?
Right.
So I think there is still a place for it. I mean, maybe I'm just being an optimist, but
no, for sure. In the space of artificial intelligence, I think there's still a room. But I wonder if in the larger scale, moving artificial intelligence out of the way just for a minute, just as a society, have we actually got beyond needing or valuing writing? And then I look at, I wrestle with this because I look at Netflix and it's like, yeah, like Netflix is taking off. They need content. They need writing. They need plots. So maybe we're shifting from advertising to entertainment. I don't know.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? These are all the thoughts that are going on. I don't have an answer yet.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm more on the side of, yes, writing will always be. Yeah, and I believe that because there's a certain, once you've seen your 10th baby poking your cat TikTok, you're done. Right. They're all the same.
Right.
Right. So, and I've seen TikToks by student filmmakers that are incredible. Right. It's amazing how much plot and character they can embed into a minute and a half. So that kind of stuff.
There are good ones and bad ones, right?
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
good ones leave you with something.
Yeah.
And the bad ones leave you like a bag of chips with nothing.
Right? Yeah.
Just to stomach it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, which brings us to, I know the Creative Advertising Program has just undergone a major modification. What are your thoughts on the program now versus what it was, say, 5 years ago?
I'm not going to give you a good answer because I'm not that familiar. I mean, I can give you my perspective on it. 5 years ago, it felt more, I think, I could get this wrong because I don't know the new program all that well. It hasn't been delineated particularly for me, but I'm sort of seeing it in bit by bit, in pieces. But I think we're seeing a more holistic approach to it now. I think that seems to be the direction we're going, which I think is great because I would encourage, that's what's happening in the real world. I still have one foot in I still freelance and I still, haul myself downtown and work in offices or work remotely or whatever, but that is the way the world is going and that is the way we have to be.
Mm. So speaking of filmmaking, I was really happy to see that one of your favorite movies is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Yeah. I was literally just listening to that amazing score by Ennio Morricone. Why does that movie appeal to you so much?
Well, my first answer, when I first gave the answer to that, it was Glengarry Glen Ross, which for the writing. I mean, David Mamet is a killer. But it's a play, and it's really not the answer to the question. The question is, what's your favorite movie? So there's no, beyond being a great play and there's not much more to that. So make that my best play. Favorite movie is The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. We talked about it just a few moments before this interview began, but the plot, it's a 3-hour movie that goes by in about 35 minutes in my head. There's so much going on. The acting, you got Clint Eastwood, who, was a sort of, he wasn't really discovered yet. He was still up and coming at that point, right? Becoming this nameless, faceless. Your hero doesn't have a name. You got Lee Van Cleef, who's a B actor. He's been in sort of like some stuff that no one's really ever heard of. He becomes, that launches his career. So you got great actors, the potential of great actors that bloom into great acting. You got Sergio Leone, his direction is the guy can't even speak the same language as his lead actor. And yet the direction. You look at some of those shots, like the cinematography, you know, you've got the tiny horse riding across this dusty landscape, and it's about the size of a pinprick. And then it cuts to a really ugly guy's nostrils. You know what I mean? Like the way he moves the camera around, the way he tells the story, the soundtrack, as you mentioned, is just, it's still, people listen to it without watching the movie. It's music now, yeah. Right? Ennio Morricone, as we were talking earlier, actually kind of has almost redefined what modern classical music is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a movie, right? I mean, the locations. You were shooting in Spain to look like Utah, to look like Southern Texas. You know, it's just an unbelievable production and an unbelievable work. It's a masterpiece. And it redefines, beyond all that, it redefines an entire genre. The Western was Yul Brynner, clean, scrubbed people. I've been to the Universal Studios lot. They put the cowboys in the small doorway so they look like big, tough guys. They put the little women in the oversized doorway so they look like diminutive little. It was this fake, everybody wore a bandana that had just been dry cleaned. You know what I mean? And you've got these ugly people that don't even speak English because it's all overdubbed in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, right? But it just felt gritty. It felt real. He reinvented it wasn't reinvented again until Clint Eastwood did Unforgiven.
Mm, yeah, another great movie. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is one of those movies where if you come across it while you're scrolling, you stop.
Yeah.
Every time,
yeah.
No matter how many times you've seen it. This is James Dunlop, who is a professor in the creative advertising program at Seneca. So I'm looking at the 3 points you said Brennan, our radio grad, who did the interview with you ahead of this interview. You said 3 things. You said the 3 points you want to get across are, 1, you're better off regretting the things you have done than the things you've left undone. You said, don't ask someone how much they like what you've done. Ask what they don't like. Seek criticism. Mm-hmm. And try to resist knowledge, or at least control it, to stay childish and curious. So are there any of those points you want to expand on?
Maybe the greatest one is the last one. I think Steve Jobs has mentioned it. Other creative heroes of mine have mentioned it. It's not my own. I've gathered it over the years. I went to a creative seminar on how to be creative, given by a great creative director who's retired from the industry now. He described knowledge as like a gravitational pull. When you're looking at that blank page again, you want to write down something familiar. It just feels good to write down. You're sucked towards wanting to... It feels comfortable to stay in that oatmeal zone, right? But children don't have that restriction. They just go. They just do whatever they like. And there's an innocence to it, yes. But there's also a curiosity and a limitless. They go wherever they want and they find something new and they write it down. It might be garbage, but they write it down or they think it up and they say it. And it might just be a scribble, but it might not be a scribble. It might be something that turns into something great. And that comes from, I think, staying hungry, staying curious, not being brought in by that gravitational pull, trying to resist that gravitational pull whenever you can, or writing it down and getting out of your head and going somewhere else.
Mm. Yeah, really, really wise advice. And I know when I'm writing a speech or a presentation, I try to get to that place, but it seems to get more difficult the older you get.
It does, because we know more.
Yeah.
And that gravity gets stronger because we're not dealing with the moon's gravity now. We're dealing with the sun's gravity. It's that big, right?
Yeah.
It's harder. And I would, I'm in the creative field and I would encourage, what did Picasso say? I spent my whole life trying to draw like a child, learning to draw like a child. There's a genius who's saying it. So it's not just me. I'm picking it up, as I say, from other people. But, your students are probably in their 20s. Most of them probably. They're already infected. They're already 20 years of knowledge. So try and get that out of your head. Stay hungry. Stay blank and curious.
Stay anti-tope.
Stay anti-tope.
Thank you so much, James. This has been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed it.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
No, I've really enjoyed this. Thanks for having me on. And... I look forward to more if there are.
Awesome. It's been a pleasure talking to you, James. James Dunlop, a professor in the Creative Advertising Program at Seneca. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Dean's Desk with Kurt Mueller, Dean of the Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design, produced by Seneca's Radio Broadcasting students.